Some of you may, perhaps, in your browsing in the bookstore, have seen this particular book on the shelf. It's called Light in Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall. And in a letter to all of the faculty earlier this year, this book was suggested as the background reading for all the faculty. And I don't know how explicitly it's been used by others on the faculty thus far, but I'm sure the name has been dropped a few places. When I read the book through, I was struck by how often the author referred to the notion of nature in the book, and so I thought this morning perhaps I'd draw a little bit from it and then try to go on from there. I don't want to give a review of the book, but possibly if I could say enough about it, you might be enticed to pick the book up yourself and read through it. The basic concern of the author in this book is that of considering an image of man, or an image of humanity, attempting to see how we look at ourselves, and this partly or to a large extent in the context of nature. And so if I could outline just briefly part of his argument. The other day on Tuesday, I referred to a period in history when science was beginning to develop and flex its muscles and grew significantly in its strength. And that period is basically the time from Copernicus, about 1542, when he published his book on the revolution of the spheres, to the time when Darwin published his book on the origin of the species in 1859. This was a time of very rapid growth in the world of science. And as I suggested the other day, it was a time when science began to sense more of its power, and there developed in science a kind of arrogance I think we can't deny. I referred the other day to Laplace, who said that given the state of the universe at any particular time, you could predict what its state would be at any time in the future. And correspondingly, he could tell you what the state of the universe was any time in the past. Well, that's an extremely arrogant statement, it seems to me, that expresses a tremendous amount of confidence in what science had achieved. Well, Mr. Hall takes this period as a time when he says what should have happened didn't happen. He says that whereas man came to understand that he no longer was at the center of the universe, but rather that the universe had its center elsewhere, if anywhere at all, but certainly not in the world. That should have made him a humble creature, but to a large extent the opposite happened. And he began to worship the techniques and the technology he had whereby he could understand and interpret nature. And he took on a kind of an arrogance as a result of this. And out of this grew the idea that man is basically the master of his world. And of course we can find some arguments for this in the Old Testament itself, when at the end of the creation story we read that man is to have dominion over this creation that he sees about him. Well, part of the burden of Hall's book is to attack this notion of mastery and to say that it's a wrong interpretation of the idea of having dominion over the earth. We have, he says, taken the word mastery to mean subjugation. Somehow we approach nature, or have approached it in the past, with the feeling that we have every right to treat this nature in whatsoever way we wish, as though we were owners of it, as though we possessed this nature. And the idea of ownership keeps coming up from time to time in his book too. And along that line, you know, it really is a little bit presumptuous of us to speak about ownership of, let's say, a tract of land. Here is a piece of land that has been in existence since the time of creation, and this bit of property that I call mine has provided food for generations before, and after I am dead and gone, others will come along and till the same ground and seek to get food and nourishment from that ground. It's a little bit arrogant of me to say that this piece of ground is mine, I own it, and I can do whatsoever I wish with this piece of ground. And this idea fits in with the notion of mastery that Paul says has become so dominant in our understanding of, or our approach to nature. Now, possibly this attitude of mastery should have changed in more recent times, but he claims it's still very much with us. And only a generation or so ago from pulpits you could have heard quoted the lines of poetry, "I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul, and let the rest of the world be damned." I recall hearing a few years ago, it wasn't more than perhaps 7 or 10 years ago, a sermon, and I don't recall the text nor the reason for bringing up the subject, but at some point in the sermon the pastor wanted to illustrate the nature of man. I suspect that's what it was. And so he said, look at a herd of wild horses and consider now how much more beautiful they are once man has taken one of these horses and has domesticated it and made this horse a thing that is tame and docile, and how much finer and better this horse is now that man has had a hand in taming it. I left that worship service with a terrible feeling in my heart. I winced when I heard him say this, because while I think there are places where we as human beings obviously must take a role of taming and in a sense dominating, to simply see any instance of this kind of taming of nature as always good and right, to me seems to go against what a right approach to nature is. And to express this very idea of mastery that has so much dominated our thinking in the past. And I don't know how many of you are hunters, and I don't want to offend anyone greatly, but just a few weeks ago I was at my home, and I went to a church picnic in the afternoon, and I met a lot of old friends there. One of them had recently traveled to Africa, and he told me he went to Africa because he wanted to shoot a lion. It wasn't because he had any interest necessarily in he didn't need lion meat for food, that was quite clear, but his only objective was to go there and to shoot a lion, to have this experience. And that kind of of activity I would put in the same category. The only motivation, it seemed to me, for this was to somehow express this mastery over creation and to prove to creation or to prove to some species that by golly, you better watch out because I'm your master and I can do with you as I will. Now, I don't want to go into all sorts of further explications of this, but and I think all of us are fully aware that this notion of mastery has had some very dire consequences. And these I don't care to review either, because you find them increasingly in the literature today, except to quote for one bit from Paul's book. This is taken from a writing of René Dubos, a very well-respected, prestigious scientist in the U.S. who perhaps has shown more conscience in this direction than many others have. He says, "My own view of man as a biological animal suggests that something worse than extinction is in store for us. Man will survive as a species for one reason. He can adapt to almost anything. I am sure we can adapt to the dirt, pollution, and noise of a New York or Tokyo. But that is the real tragedy. We can adapt to it. It is not man the ecological crisis threatens to destroy, but the quality of human life, the attributes that make human life different from animal life." You could find a lot of other statements by people like Paul Ehrlich, who likewise speak about the way in which we threaten our own existence by the way in which we have dealt with nature itself. So, what Hall is arguing for is a new image of man. And here I'll leave Hall for the most part and make some other comments. A rather interesting article appeared in the Christian Science Monitor a few weeks ago. This was in the April 10th issue of 1978. It reports on a forum that was held at Harvard University with a number of theologians participating in it. And I think a number of these points are rather interesting, though they don't all pertain to the question of nature that we're talking about this morning. So for what they're worth, I'll read them through. The first theologian reported on is a woman theologian, Patricia Budd Kepler, an ordained minister of the Presbyterian Church. And she reported on her studies in liberation theology and said, interestingly, theologians will re-examine what it means to have dominance over the world. Humanity will rediscover its spiritual relationship to the natural order, and, for example, the distinction between the human world and the animal world will be less defined. Now, we have often thought of God being here, the created order down below, and man stuck in between, as a kind of combination of godly qualities and qualities of the animal world. And it's Ms. Kepler's judgment in this report that mankind will see himself identified more strongly with the animal kingdom in the future. And there's also here a report from Dean Stendahl, whose name many of you know, perhaps the most well-known of Lutheran theologians at Harvard. He says there will be plenty of religion in the year 2000. That is, he sees a lot of diversity arising in theology, because it is clear now that human beings are religious by nature. In the future, it will be religion growing out of a feeling of helplessness, which I think is significant, because it sort of counters this notion of mastery that has tended to dominate a lot of our thinking about our relationship to nature. And so both of these people that spoke at this, these two people in particular at this particular conference, it seems to me, are speaking somewhat along the same lines in their comments about our place in nature. One of the most derogatory things I suppose we can say about another person is to say, well, he's an animal. He's just an animal. I've sometimes felt that statement is really a little unfair, probably to the animals. And I hope that we can develop a little keener sense and a deeper love for the animal kingdom. I think it's undeniable that we are a part in many ways of the animal kingdom. And it's never really offended me if in reading a text in biology or some article by a biologist or zoologist, he has referred to us as part of the animal kingdom. Somehow that's never bothered me. Maybe it should. In fact, sometimes I felt that I felt a strong affinity in this way, and have not seen it in any way as derogatory to be classed among the animals. Indeed, we have qualities that are different from the animals and set us apart, but in so many ways we are a part of the animal kingdom, and it seems to me it's time we recognize this a little more clearly. We read in scriptures that man is made a little lower than the angels. But we also find, for example, in 1 Timothy 4:4, where we read, every creature of God is good. And I would take that to mean that we are, in a sense, considered together with the kingdom of the animals, for example. That we, along with the animals, are part of God's good creation. And the other night in Vespers, a text from Romans 8:22 was read, where Paul writes that all creation groans and travails together in pain. And that as mankind suffers, nature suffers. And as nature suffers, so we suffer. And how important it is today to sense this in our dealing with nature, coming to understand that when we hurt nature, we are, in a sense, hurting ourselves, because we are profoundly dependent upon it. We're dependent upon it in obvious ways. It provides us with our food and our shelter, but I would suggest we cannot even fulfill our mission as Christians, our mission to our neighbor, if we disrespect and disregard nature. There is no way in which I could speak to you or you to me, in fact, if it were not for nature. The very sound of your voice is carried by the natural order. The very sight of a friend is brought to your mind by waves of light and by the optics of your eye and the nervous system of your body. We would be completely isolated from one another as sort of floating spirits or something if it weren't for the existence of nature. And our environment is the means whereby mankind communicates with itself. We could not fulfill Christ's mission if it were not for the created order. We could not express love and affection to others. We could not give gifts. We could not bring food to hungry people if it were not for means of transportation and if it were not for the materials we use to transport and to carry. Command in the New Testament that Jesus gives us is that we shall love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind, and our neighbor as ourselves. We cannot effectively love God or our neighbor if we despise his creation. There is no way, it seems to me, there is no way that I can love God and love my neighbor if at the same time I am destructive toward nature. If I do not have a kind of compassion and sense of love toward the things of the field, toward the animal kingdom, I cannot fully love my neighbor, nor can I fully express my love to God. And correspondingly, to be a good steward of the earth is one way of showing love to God and love to my neighbor. There are three very basic entities involved here. There's God and my neighbor and nature. One of the most famous classics in this whole area of science and religion is a book written by William Temple a number of years ago called Nature, Man, and God, in which he picks out these three things as being, as expressing the totality of life, really. You can, from these three, take out any one of them. Take out, for example, the relationship to God, and you have man relating only to nature and to his fellow man, to his neighbor. There are people who live like that. They do not have a belief in God, but they somehow relate to nature and they relate to their fellow man. Take out the matter of man, of our fellow man or our neighbor. Some people live with this kind of a basic orientation. They believe in God and they worship God in nature, but they are not particularly conscious of their neighbor. And so likewise, you could remove the notion of nature from these, from this group of three. But to be full in our life, to be complete in our life, we must somehow bring all three of these into our understanding and concern ourselves with our relationship to each one of these three, to God and to man, or to our neighbor and to nature. It's interesting that in the Old and New Testament alike, quite often the notion of sin arises in a context that relates to nature. In the story of creation, we find that after Adam and Eve had lost their innocence, they were cast out of the garden. And this suggests to us, or tells us, that the harmony that existed between man and nature was disrupted by his sinfulness, by his disobedience to God. And in the New Testament, the story of the temptation of Jesus takes place out in the desert, and there Jesus is asked to turn a stone into bread. And you could look at other examples in the Old and New Testaments where this notion of sin and disobedience is expressed, and find the same kind of context. The Old and New Testaments are by no means ignorant of nature. So then, with these thoughts in mind, we are concerned about a new image of who we are. And if we take a clue from Dean Stendahl's remarks, perhaps we should include in that image of ourselves this notion of dependence. That we are not such lords of nature that we may willy-nilly do what we wish with it, but we are to understand ourselves as profoundly dependent upon nature. And we are assigned the role in nature of one who cares, and who cares with a kind of lovingness. That we care for nature's sake, and for our fellow man's sake. I think the environmental movement has about it some very strong theological dimensions, and is one that we perhaps should give some more time to here at Holden. It's an image of man that is concerned about nature in such a way that we care for it without making demands that she always compensate us beyond our due. That we care for nature without exploiting it. There is a strain of this attitude toward nature, I think, in religious literature in general, and certainly in Christian literature. St. Francis of Assisi is such a well-known example of a person who had this kind of a caring love toward nature. And sometimes we look at a figure like that as being so romantic and a kind of an oddity. But the way which we have been pursuing in our treatment of the earth, I think, calls for a little more of St. Francis's attitude toward nature. I'll never forget the first time I read Albert Schweitzer's account of his own life, in which he speaks of floating down a river one day in Africa. He had for a long time been pondering what really brought together his attitude toward this world. And he says, as he was going down the river this day, all of a sudden it came to him, the phrase, reverence for life. And, of course, out of that grew much of his later writing and much of his work in Africa later on, and his profound respect for God's created order. And then also Martin Buber, whose name many of you may know. He's a Jewish writer who died some years ago, but who has written very profoundly on the subject I, Thou, and especially his essay on the tree is one that's often referred to. And if you're not familiar with Martin Buber, I think you might enjoy reading something of his works. And then just the other day, I don't think the fellow is here now, but I hope he won't mind my telling his story, because it was very fascinating to me. There is a fellow still in camp. I saw him at breakfast this morning from Minnesota. And he said that a few weeks ago, he was going to his place of work, which I don't know exactly what it was, but I had the impression it was out in the timber somewhere. He himself is a carpenter, and as he goes to work each day, he passes by a pit that has been dug in the ground to catch refuse and a lot of greasy material. Well, he said on this one day he was going to work, he passed by this pit, and he saw in the pit a small dog that had fallen into this terrible mess at the bottom of the pit, about three feet deep, I guess, and the dog could not jump out. And the dog was obviously much distressed and filthy because he'd been in this mess of grease at the bottom of the pit. So the fellow stopped, and he reached down, grabbed a hold of the dog, raised the dog to the ground, and the dog shook himself furiously, and then ran off, got about 20 or 30 feet away, stopped, turned around, came back, wagged his tail, and went off. So we think sometimes that nature is insensitive to us. I don't think it is. Now, well, I think I'll stop here, and I'd be interested in your reactions, in your comments along this line, or any observations you have.
Phil, in this sense of mastery that man seems has had over the years, do you feel this is reflected somewhat in Menninger's book, for example, called Whatever Became of Sin? And also comments I've even gotten from Lutheran pastors who said, for example, in our opening liturgy, he says, I don't really go along with that, where it says, we are by nature sinful and unclean, that we've sinned against you by thought, word, and deed. Is this, I wonder, these attitudes somewhat reflected because of man's feeling of mastery over everything, that man really is the big gun? Have you experienced any of this in your sharing with students?
Well, not specifically along that line. I think that we are gradually recognizing that we really aren't the hot shots we thought we were, and that this matter of sin is, as we have always said in our Lutheran church, an extremely pervasive thing, and really does not qualify us to be masters. We have tried to be masters, and because we are basically selfish people, we have failed. And that, in a way, puts an onus upon us to sense ourselves more as a part of this animal kingdom, and to sense ourselves more as a part of the created order, rather than somehow standing equal with God and doing what we wish with nature. And perhaps we need to realize that we participate in nature more than we have wanted to in the past. I'm not sure what your reference to Menninger was getting at.
The whole concept, you know, that we are basically sinful people, that we have rebelled against God, that we've tried to take, really, you know, usurp almost mm-hmm. his authority. And I think, you know, I just wonder if we really live with the deep consciousness that we are sinners anymore. We hear so much about God's love for us, that we love and love and love, and we almost simply, you know, mm-hmm. put the other side of it almost out of sight.
Mm-hmm. Any reactions to that? Any? The rest of you have any observations along that line?
I think there's something that people, I think there are two things that get confused. I'm not sure that I have got the straight narrow to explain it, but I think that sometimes we hammer so right at the sinfulness that people have a feeling of not being a child of God. But I think in a sense it's missing the point. It's a reminder of what you're saying. I think the sinfulness comes in that we must not forget our place. We must not be too controlling, and we must remember where we fit in, but with the feeling that we are God's creatures, mm-hmm. we are by nature, maybe we're by nature sinful, but we're also by nature. I don't know. The opposite, I guess. Do you understand what I mean? I think there's two things that are confused there.
You really feel the concept of sin is really hammered away at today.
Well, I hear just about every Sunday when I go to church.
I get the feeling along that same line that we kind of maybe unwittingly, continuously can lay a guilt trip on ourselves.
And I
wonder if in trying to bring about the kinds of attitude changes and behavioral changes that we say, I think many of us say, pastors say, we want in our churches and of our people, if the way to do it is to continually lay guilt trips on people as a way of motivating them to change ideas or behavior in the direction we want, as opposed to emphasizing that which we ultimately would like to see in ourselves and focusing on that, you know, rather than the wrist slapping and, you know, the don'ts, no, as a way of trying to motivate people
mm-hmm.
to change.
Mm-hmm.
As a motivator, I suppose some people will respond to that, but I have a feeling that a lot don't. It just reinforces the inferiority feelings that people maybe already have. Anyway, I sense that it's been said the vast majority of us anyway carry feelings of inferiority with us. I don't know how it comes about, but that few of us have I'm okay, you're okay, you know, really well-developed attitude towards life and each other. And comparatively few actually have a superiority complex. And if that statement is true, and I don't know if it is, then the continuous guilt trip bit as a way of motivating us to improve, change, alter lifestyle. I have questions about it, but it's going to be. I think we've got to set our sights on positively what we want and expect of ourselves as a people and society and focus on that. And I think the fire and brimstone bit is outstepped, personally.
Yeah, well, yes,
I would agree with what you're saying. I think that we need the feeling that we are forgiven and not to constantly dwell on our sinfulness. And because of our feeling of forgiveness and that we are God's people, then we act as a grateful response to God. And then we begin caring about nature and about our fellow man and act from the positive feeling of being forgiven and being God's people. And then rather than the negative motivation of guilt.
Yeah, I hope I wasn't suggesting that the route we should take is that of of introducing again the fire and brimstone approach, because I certainly would concur that that doesn't lead us in the right direction.
I think there's a sense of pride. I mean, that's where C.S. Lewis talks about. I'm not sure that's good, but that's got a double meaning. But pride in the sense of self-righteousness, which leads us into arrogance, and arrogance
mm-hmm.
to the things that we should care for. That to me is the guilt, or not the guilt, but the sin that the religion is trying to get at, is that sin of arrogance or pride.
All right, yes, we often describe. Yeah, we often describe sin essentially as expressing itself in selfishness and concern only for me.
Getting specific now, how should we as Christians relate our attitudes to atomic generators? I told them that.
Mm-hmm. All right, reactions.
Well, I've worked in the nuclear field and been involved in site inspections for the Atomic Energy Commission of nuclear plants. And I also consider myself a Christian. And I don't know. I guess it's a question of, on the one hand, if we want hot water, and I sense most of us like showers and lamps to read by, we've got to realize that to heat our homes and to provide the energy source we need, it's got to come from someplace. Solar, water, nuclear is another form of energy. At the same time, as I have seen firsthand, there are valid concerns about radiation leakage and treatment of waste, sabotage of the transport of waste materials and finished plutonium and other uranium sources. I personally, I think it is possible to, as a Christian, view nuclear energy as, if you will, a God-given form of energy. I don't think the utility companies are out to screw the United States the people, and I hear it put that way frequently, to bring our country to its knees or deliberately use an energy source and to pollute our nation, particularly with the liability issue like it is now. They're very concerned about avoiding accidents, and probably much more conscious on that than far than most people realize. But there are risks, to be sure, and when a mistake is made, unfortunately, the damage extends not a year or two, but sometimes thousands, if not millions of years. But personally, just as one, I think it is possible to be a Christian and to approach nuclear energy and see value and benefit in it.
Yes?
Well, I think, though, we have to weigh the existence of our present lifestyle, which is dependent on energy, with the consequences of the future generation. Because we're talking here not about a technology that's been around really very long. We're talking about technological problems that pose difficulties of a magnitude never faced by mankind before. And whether we want to bother with the, talking about some of the problems of leakage and reactor meltdowns, which are possibilities, we have the broader picture of what do you do with these waste products. And I just have never heard anyone give a satisfactory explanation on what's to be done with the radioactive waste. Because I understand a lot of them are stored in the state of Washington, Hanford,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is on top of a known earthquake fault, which I might hear your reasoning behind that. And it's been said that there's enough material stored there that if it ever were released accidentally or whatever, it would be the equivalent of a major nuclear war. And this stuff stored in tanks that in other containers that happen to last longer than the pyramids. I mean, the pyramids have been around a long time, but nothing like these containers have to do with the radioactive isotopes, that some of which have radioactive half-life, thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And we're talking now about storing this stuff, and they got tanks that are leaking in 20 years. They're not going to outlast the pyramids. What civilization has ever lasted long enough to maintain these facilities? Probably the Roman Catholic Church is the oldest institution I would imagine in the world, and that's a couple thousand years old at the most. And I just, unless we have some kind of nuclear priesthood, somehow guarding. Anyway, I just don't see the response that we're being responsible for future generations. It's inevitable that these radioactive wastes will sometime get into the environment, and we know that they threaten our greatest God-given resource, I think, which is the human gene pool. That's something that has taken a long time to be created, and I think by a long-term evolutionary process. And we jeopardize that, because we're talking about a pollution that's very insidious, and it damages the DNA, the heredity. I'm not just talking about something that gives you lung cancer, and so the consequences are great.
Perhaps the first time in human history that we have been required to think in terms not only of 10-year plans and 100-year plans, but plans that reach out into the future thousands of years. Yes?
Well, when you're talking about nuclear waste, and I don't understand this very well, but you're talking about fusion and fission. You're talking about two different things, and the byproducts are two different things. I think most people associate radioactive power and so forth with what is the fission process where you do have this radioactive waste. Now, when we as we get further along with technology, the byproduct of fusion is what? Water and...
We're talking now about the fission. There's no fusion plant in operation anywhere here.
No, there could be. I mean...
We're talking now about people who want to immediately rush in to fission, which is, I think, a case of premature technology. Like the story of, you've probably been reading a number of years ago in, I guess, the 1930s and 40s, they thought people had enlarged thymus gland, and they sat them with x-rays. But then these people now are coming down with thyroid cancer. A good example of technology used before they really knew its consequences. And right now we're talking about fission reactors in operation now and more being put in. When you get the fusion, that's perhaps a different story, but we're rushing into operation now with fission reactors that do create these waste products. And we're not talking about little tiny capsules of waste products. We're talking about entire railroad cars of equipment that eventually have to be buried and stuff. Some people say put them in a rocket, you know, and send them in outer space. But you know how my car doesn't run very well. If I put something in a rocket, it might land in Minneapolis.
And just as a footnote on one of the other, I agree with what in essence, what the last speaker said. As a footnote on what was said prior, lest we confuse the alleged magnanimity of industry, this state's a good example of what industry's been able to do to limit liability in both the areas of oil spillages with terrible environmental impact, and also in this question of nuclear production. And they've been successful. Puget Sound Power and Light and others here have been successful in lobbying for legislation to limit liability substantially. So I don't think we should be confused about the altruism of these industrial giants as much as we'd like to believe in them.
That's one other point. If these reactors are so safe, why don't insurance companies insure them for them, whatever it might happen? They always say there's a one chance in a billion that a reactor would melt down, where it loses coolant and melts down and releases radioactive gases into the environment. But if they're so damn safe, why does the government have to step in to insure them and then limit it to a certain amount of money? Another issue besides the waste
price issue. I think it's probably because a loss would be so devastating, it's not really an insurable loss. I mean, it's that one in it might be a money-making vehicle if it's that safe. Then the other end, if it ever happens, it's almost got to be, you've got to be self-insured. I mean, it's got to be the government or somebody else. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to think about that because...
I don't believe it is ridiculous, and I think that if there is going to be, if even in the zone of consideration, there's that type of catastrophic loss, let the industrial empire cave in on that. Let the industrial empire fall, if that's the case. And there should be unlimited liability. I don't follow that reasoning at all.
Well, where's the Christian's approach or role in this, I suppose, then, assuring that be it nuclear industry or solar, or what is done be done responsibly in terms of its impact on all of society, not just the entrepreneurs of the nuclear industry or the solar energy, but all of mankind in general. And I suppose a concern aesthetics with being in tune with nature, as you were talking about, and so forth, that that be respected and observed. Whether the issue is nuclear or otherwise, because strip mining of coal, some might argue, in eastern Montana and Utah and Midwest states, they produce ultimately as much blight and disruption of the environment as maybe some aspects of nuclear. That yet is another way of producing energy that we're going to need.
Well, when I hear the industry being blamed, it, you know, we all know that industries make their money because consumers buy their products. Now, what changes, in line with your statement, well, Christian, what changes would we be willing to assume in order that there would not be a need for nuclear power? And what reduction in the consumption of energy, and how are we willing to change our lifestyle so that we wouldn't need to buy their products? They're going to produce them if we buy them.
Well, we have a governor in this state that's pushing nuclear power. And so we have one plant being built out at SATSA, but another one on the drawing boards up here at Skagit, which is, they found that the main part of that nuclear plant will be right on a earthquake fault.
Your governor of the farmer of the Economic Energy Commission dead there.
Right.
Not sure what I'm asking.
I think his question was a very different one.
I think nature.
How so? You want to elaborate on that?
Well, I think what he's asking is if not nuclear or other forms of energy that we have problems with because of the ultimate impact on society and on the environment, what changes might we be willing to make in our own lifestyle? I was on a plane once, for example, just out of D.C., and one of the Israeli foreign ministers was in the plane next to me, and he said, "You Americans." I said, "I can't believe it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I just stayed in some of your downtown Washington hotels, and the amount of hot water that you need to take a shower or you have available with you just in your motel and your hotel rooms in the United States is, my God, a whole Israeli family could take a shower on half the quantity of water you people seem to need to bathe in." And he went on and cited aspect after aspect of American lifestyle that he viewed from his perspective as incredibly wasteful. And I think, we spent 2 years in South America in the Andes, and I know what we got by with in terms of, you know, needs and consumption. And I do have the feeling that a lot of the energy that we say we need to exist on as a lifestyle, we can in fact do without and can alter. I think a lot of the energy problem, I feel maybe we bring on ourselves and have brought ourselves. How many of us here own 2 and 3 automobiles?
Yes.
I was just thinking that one of the problems right in our camp here, some of the young people don't like the eats. They really object to it. Well, it's an adjustment we have to make, and we'll, as it says in this pamphlet that we were given here yesterday, we may have to make them before too long. And I don't know, I've enjoyed the eats.
Yes.
Well, I would like to be an optimist and say that through Christian concern, you can minimize the impact of our energy needs on the environment in this map. I'm, I guess, cynical or whatever it is enough to believe that the only way you're going to do this is to put a price tag on it. And if you're going to limit gasoline consumption, you're just going to have to price it in such a way that it becomes a scarce commodity, so people use less of it, and some way, maybe with water or any other thing. Now, maybe there's another way of getting at it. Maybe it's an awareness. Maybe it's a long-term thing. And I'm not saying that can't happen, but I'm not very optimistic about that right now. I think if you want to really be limiting certain things, you've got to do it through hit them in the pocketbook. Now, that sounds cynical, but I don't know. Gasoline is not going to be. People aren't going to cut down their gas consumption until they're paying $1, $2 a gallon. And I'm not sure that's even going to work because they still
people can afford it.
Cheap in the dollar. Keep right on.
Bill?
Yes.
I'll put in a plug. Sometimes the church is way behind, and once in a while the church has tried to do something and people don't know about it. I think this would be a good
issue for a typical Sunday morning congregation adult Bible class. I mean, it's pertinent. It has some ramifications as to lifestyle, faith, and what have you. The ALC, I think in February, put out a new adult series. It's called Viewpoints, and there is one of those on energy. It has some of the debate. It has some of the ramifications. It has some of the fact that it's probably going to have to be economics, has one on lifestyle changes that are part of that. It's really fairly good as a possible source to continue this discussion at home. So, but because I think it's a good one. I think we're really going to face it.
Yes. But aren't you going to have people say, I think we should have Bible study?
Well, it is a Bible study.
Yes, maybe, it is, but they, will, they don't consider it.
Yeah. Well,
because it hurts.
That'll...
See, then the young people turn around and say to us,
I think it's a dollar for
they say, sure, that's fine. You put restrictions on us now. Why didn't you put them on yourself 20 years ago? Why do I have to suffer now? Because you mishandled things. Who are you to limit me? I've got to suffer because of your past action. It's unfair. The young people.
The problem is going backwards. I mean, in a sense, it isn't really, to my way of thinking, it's probably an enrichment that we would go into this instead of starting to have this feeling of respect and reverence for the things we deal with. But in a sense, we have to go back and give up. And it's always easy to go and gather more, but it's really hard to start shedding. I think
I
know.
Now, consciously, I've tried to simplify our family life. It's a very difficult thing to try to do. I think I've worked at it for maybe 5-7 years, and if you make a little headway, you're lucky. The pressures of society are so great, and the idea of my children, as they grow, wanting more and more of the recreational type toys, and our own, my husband and my own desire for some more, especially when it's constantly presented to you. I feel what I do is so insignificant to make any real change. And this one individual doing something to make a difference. It's very frustrating. I live with it nagging at me constantly, and I'm sure some of the residents have the same feeling. Kind of one day I read a newspaper and a big full-page ad of numerous appliances to buy that were on sale. On the page facing it was an article concerning our electrical company needing to build a nuclear power plant. And I just thought it was ironic. Why, it certainly explains why the need for the nuclear plant was there. If anyone has any ideas of how to make life simple,
I think Brian said that it seems to me, he said 50% of our energy,
the Scandinavian countries that are certainly not backward countries use a little less than half the energy per capita that we do. So much of it is not really enhancing our life.
The power companies a few years ago were pushing for more lights would decrease crime.
Yes, yeah.
No, I just get plain cheap with an
animal. Maybe we ought to have more people speaking out like she does, because I feel the same way. Maybe if we band together, we'd realize we're not the only ones. I get the same feeling about voting, about world hunger, about so many things that you feel so frustrated because you're so small. But if more people would speak out and say, I go around the house and I'm constantly turning off lights, or I see to it that, you know, I fix water leaks or whatever the problem is, you know, if it were known that there are others that you're not alone in, it wouldn't seem like such a drop in the bucket.
We had a forum on concrete first steps. And somebody asked for it, so we started it at 10:15. I think this was 2 weeks ago. And I thought there'd be six people. There were 140 people in here. The balcony was filled, and we went into small groups of six or eight, and it went till something like 11:20 without any lack of energy. And what it was people found out other people were wrestling with the same thing, We're trying to take some first steps, and so it's very much alive. Maybe Phil can. I keep forgetting that every week there's a new population, because we just did that and we went through this, but it's true, probably not many of those people are here. It's a very lively topic.
Isn't there an open meeting tonight?
Tonight is communities, urban communities, and it's not unrelated to this. The title is not exactly advertising this, but I think Paul Haynes will, and Paul Halverson, if he's in on it, certainly will. He has Shakertown Pledge and talks about new communities that are, in essence, trying to do some of these things. So tonight's topic is related to this. Taking Charge, a little book in the bookstore, is sold out. I don't know if we have any more or not. That's very practical first step.
But the first steps trying to save can have repercussions in the opposite way. It'll take more out of your pocketbook. For example, in Tucson, they have this, you know, beach peak. Between 4 and 8 o'clock, you're not the water, and you water only every other day. So the people did this, and the response was tremendous, that the great amount of water was saved. So what does the water company say? Hey, our revenues are down now. We've got to raise the rates because we got to get more money in. You know, you did the job, but now it's hurt us. So, you know.
Well, I think that we'll stop with that. Thank you all for coming.